Our speaker this morning is Elder Gordon B. Hinckley, assistant to the Quorum of the Twelve. Brother Hinckley gave the commencement address to the graduating class of 1958. This is his first appearance before the student body as a member of the General Authorities. In the universe yesterday morning and again this morning, you were very well introduced to Brother Hinckley. Therefore, in the interest of time, we're very happy to turn to him now for his address. Elder Gordon B. Hinckley.
My dear brethren and sisters, students and faculty and student, I'd better watch the order of things here. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm grateful for Brother Ludlow's prayer. I pray that the Spirit of the Lord may direct me in those things which I say. I've thought to talk on a subject with which most of you are familiar, but I hope that I may be able to say some things that are informative. I was reading the other day the anecdotes from Lincoln, which are in the February Reader's Digest, and enjoyed the story which he told of a man who found himself on a dark night, in strange country. And a terrible thunderstorm came up, and he could make his way only as the lightning flashed. And as the thunder roared, he began to get frightened, and with a great clap of thunder, he fell to his knees and said in a prayer, "Lord, if it's all the same with you, I'd like a little more light and a little less noise." Perhaps I can shed just a little light on a program of the church without which none of you would be here this day. I speak of the missionary program. For the past several years, I've had the responsibility of working with President Stephen L. Richards in administering the missionary program of the church. I'd like all those here who have been on missions to raise your hands. Most of you, I guess, that's magnificent. I think even you who've been out on the front line may know something about the cause, may not know some of these things about the cause in which you have been engaged. My wife and I were in England in September. And for the dedication of the temple, and we went up to Preston, Lancashire, where the gospel was first introduced 121 years ago, and where I first labored as a missionary 25 years ago. I walked those streets which were familiar to Heber C. Kimball and his six associates, where I had walked many months down Fishergate and Friargate and across the old flag market where they had held street meetings and we had held street meetings, the site of the cockpit where they had preached, the River Ribble where they had first baptized, and many other familiar places. And as I looked into the faces of the people of Lancashire, I couldn't help feeling sorry for them. Now that may sound very egotistical and very presumptuous, but as I looked into their faces, I felt sorry. I felt sorry for the fact that the great majority of them had rejected the gospel 121 years ago when the first missionaries came there. And frankly, I felt sorry that they'd rejected us when we had been there. And I felt sorry that they were rejecting the missionaries who now are there. When I came home, I happened to pick up the talk which President Wilkinson gave at Thomas L. Martin's funeral and read it. I hadn't read it before. in which President Wilkinson told of Brother Martin's story, of his having come out of Lancashire, his father having been a pit miner, and Brother Martin himself having been a pit miner. And I thought and marveled and was grateful for the great missionary program which had touched the lives of a few people and brought light and life and opportunity and goodness and truth to them. We went from Lancashire back down to the temple, and as we met the saints there and saw the difference, their cleanness, the light in their eyes somehow, an indefinable something which had come of the restored gospel of Jesus Christ, I was grateful for the great missionary program of the church, which accounts also for your presence here and for all which you have. I think you may like to know that there are about 80,000 missionaries have now gone into the field. I suppose that's about 200,000 man years of missionary effort in this church. About 200,000 man years of missionary effort. I'm sure that a few of you appreciate the heartaches, the sorrows, the sacrifices, the romance, the cost of it, the results of it. The other day I picked up this little thing which I read many years ago, published by Don MacDalton, the story of his mother. She writes of this concerning the time that her husband was in the mission field. She was then a little girl in Parowan. My mother had to work like a slave to keep her children while father was on his mission. I remember how every night she would spin and how in the daytime I would split fine splinters off from the pitchy wood. And at night I would sit with her and tend the baby and keep holding and lighting these pitchy sticks for her to see to spin by. And how I would cry when I went to bed to think my mother had to work so hard while father was on a mission in Denmark. I remember the Christmas of 1862. All of us children hung up our stockings. We jumped up early in the morning to see what Santa had brought, but there was not a thing in them. Mother wept bitterly. She went to her box and got a little apple and cut it in little tiny pieces. And that was our Christmas. But I have never forgotten to this day how I loved her hands as she was cutting that apple. That's what it cost. I was interested in doing a little research on the Johnson Army episode a while ago and discovered that while the army was marching toward this valley, or toward the valley to the north of us, and while the people living there were fleeing to this valley, men were leaving for the mission field. In 1849, and 50, while the great gold rush to California was on, while men were traveling over land and sea in search of wealth in the hills and along the rivers of California, men were leaving these valleys to travel over land and sea in search of souls. There never has been a time in the history of the church, from the day when Samuel Smith walked in adjoining communities to sell the Book of Mormon, when there have not been messengers of salvation go out from the homes of the saints. I think you may be interested to know that we now have 5,500 missionaries approximately in the foreign fields. They are spending an average of $67 per month. Their parents are sending them from these communities approximately $4.5 million a year to maintain them in the field. The parents who pay their tithes and offerings and build the chapels, the parents who send their sons and daughters to this institution, are likewise sending approximately $4.5 million in consecrated money to maintain their sons and daughters in the field. If the value of those missionaries' time were very conservatively estimated, it would certainly come to another $5.5 million, making a contribution of more than $10 million a year to the promulgation of the gospel in strange places. Never was there a time when missionary work was more productive than it is now. We are prone to look upon the old days as the great days of harvest, and these days as the great days of gleaning. I think you may be interested in knowing that in 1958, we had about 33 or 34,000 convert baptisms. 22,349 of these in what we call the foreign missions, the full-time missions. Another 9,000 some odd in the stakes, and roughly 1,500 to 1,800 performed by friends, bishops, and so on, making at least 33,000 convert baptisms in 1 year. The equivalent of 7.5 new stakes, average stakes, or 55 new wards in a single year in convert baptisms. I was interested to note when I was checking some figures yesterday that in 1954, just 5 years ago, we had fewer than 10,000 convert baptisms in the church, which was the highest year in the history of the church. And in a period of 5 years, we have increased that to more than 22,000 in the foreign fields. More than 100% gain in convert baptisms in a 5-year period. Now, brethren and sisters, those figures may be dull, but they're tremendously significant. Those are not peas in a pod. Those are not automobiles on a production line. Those are men and women, sons and daughters of our Father in heaven, into whose hearts and lives have come the truths of the restored gospel of the Master. Nobody knows. Nobody can predict the consequences of those 33,000 conversions. Within a period of a year, why these things roll forth like a snowball coming down a mountain, gathering masses, it rolls. One generation builds on another. The effects of missionary work. I could stay here for a long time and tell you the effects on the parents. I won't. I'll just tell you one story. There came into the office a while ago a man who wanted to take a car to his son in the mission field. He said, "My boy is riding a bicycle and I'm afraid he's going to get killed. Can I take a car to him?" I said, "You can if the mission president feels that he needs one." So letters went back and forth and finally approval was given to take a car. The man came in after he'd taken the car. He said, "You know, I'm kind of proud of my boy in the field, but we've never been able to get along. That's a strange thing. There are often rifts between fathers and sons." He said, "There's always been a gap between us." Well, he came back in the office after he'd been to take the car. And he said, "I want to tell you what happened. This man's a wealthy man." He said, "I took the car. I drove 1,000 miles to deliver the car to my son, and I went to his place of lodging and rang the bell. And he came to the door and he said, "Hello, Dad. Glad to see you. Is that the car?" He said, "I'm late for a meeting. Come around at 8 o'clock tonight down at so-and-so and maybe I'll have a few minutes to visit with you. Goodbye." He said, "I hadn't seen him for 16 months. And that's the kind of reception I got. And I was miffed." He said, "I felt like getting in the car and driving back home. But," he said, "I went out and got some dinner and took a little nap and thought better of it and went to the hall where they were having a baptismal service. My boy was the supervising elder of the district. He said, "I arrived late and I sat on the back row. And they had just finished the baptismal service and were having something of a testimony meeting. And a man stood up and he said, 'I'm retired. I've made some money. I've traveled around this world. I thought I had seen everything and had everything.' And one day that young man who's sitting right there came to my door. Time was heavy on my hands. I let him in. I listened to him. And he intrigued me. And I listened again. And he has brought something to me more wonderful than all I've ever seen or all I've ever known. And I want to stand here and bear testimony of the truth of what he brought. And before you people here express gratitude to the Lord for having sent that young man to my door.' Father said he was talking of my boy. And he said, 'I'm not a sentimental sort of a guy, but the tears began to roll off my cheeks.' He said, 'I've come closer to my boy in one day in the mission field and I came in 20 years at home.' He said, 'I've concluded to be a better man myself. I've been doing a little smoking, having my coffee, but,' he said, 'I can never touch it again after that experience.' The effect on the fathers and the mothers, I could stand here for a long time and tell you of those things. On the converts, I was interested in a story which Brother Callis told to me just before he died. He came in the office one day and sat down across the desk and told this story. He said, 'When I was president of the Southern States Mission, I had every missionary come into the office before he was released. And one day a boy came in and I said, "What have you accomplished?" And he said, "Nothing. And I'm going home." "What do you mean you've accomplished nothing?" "Well," he said, "I baptized one man back in the backwoods of Tennessee. I think it was Tennessee. Who didn't know enough or have enough to wear shoes. And that's all I've done. I wasted my time and my father's money. And I'm going home." Brother Callis said, "I went up into that area 6 months later to check on that man. And the sense of failure with which that boy went home fascinated me. And I went up and checked on that man. And I found he'd put on shoes. And moreover, he'd put on a white shirt and a tie. And he'd been ordained a deacon. And he was secretary of the Sunday school in the little branch in which he lived. 2 years later, he was ordained an elder. He was superintendent of the Sunday school. He'd moved off the tenant farm on which he lived and on which his father before him had lived. He bought a little piece of ground of his own. 2 years later, he was the branch president. And a couple of years later, he'd accumulated enough sold his farm, moved to Idaho and bought a farm there, reared his family. His sons and daughters went on missions, and their sons and daughters, and Brother Callis said, I've just completed a survey which indicates, according to the best information I can find, that over 1,100 people have come into the church as a result of the conversion of one man in the back hills of Tennessee who didn't wear shoes. The effect on the converts. No boy or girl here has been on a mission who hasn't seen the miracle of conversion in the lives of those who have come into the church. Marvelous what happens. I'm going to take time to tell one more story. I have until 12 minutes to 11, Dean Clark tells me. About 2 years ago, when I was a stake president, a young man came for interview on recommendation of his bishop that he be ordained an elder. He was a hangdog, cotton-picking sort of looking kid. He was a... And I asked him some questions, and he sat with his head down looking at the floor, answering them. And I talked with him about his background. Said he'd been born in Alabama. When he was a very small child, he had been orphaned. And he'd been kicked around from relative to relative, who didn't want him, evidently. And finally, when he was about 12, they put him in an institution where he found that the supervisors were about of the same streak of kindness as his relations had been. He worked his days making brooms and lived that way until he was drafted into the Army, Air Force. Stationed at Kearns and found that the sergeants were of about the same streak again as those he'd known before. He was stationed at Kearns, and I don't want to run down Kearns, but in those days it was a windblown, dusty place. One Sunday afternoon he came into Temple Square, and a man walked up to him and said, is there anything I can do for you? Can I help you? He said that so far as he remembered, that was the only time in his life anybody had ever asked him in that tone of voice if he could be helped. So next Sunday he came back again, and somebody offered to take him to dinner. That was being done in those days to the boys in uniform. Somebody took him to dinner. He didn't remember the people, doesn't know who they were. But anyhow, when he was released from the service, he decided to come back to Salt Lake, where he'd found a little kindness. Now, I'm not inferring that everyone you meet in Salt Lake will treat you kindly, but he did. He learned of the church a little bit. He met an LDS girl and married her. The missionaries heard of him, the stake missionaries, and you know when a missionary finds someone who shows the least bit of interest, he jumps on with all 4 feet. They taught him the gospel. He joined the church. He was now ordained an elder. 3 months ago, he was made president of his elders' quorum, responsible for the spiritual, the social, and the economic welfare of 68 men. Talk about a miracle. Talk about evolution. If you'd see him today, you'd never recognize him. He walks with his head up. He knows his job. He's doing it. Even his boss has given him a very substantial raise and a different job because of what's happened to him. That's the effect of the gospel. The opportunities that come of the church to all who will take advantage of them. So much for that. A The productive missions. I'd just like to say this one thing. There seems to be a growing tendency in the church for people to want to go to particular places. Now, you people, most of you have been. But you have younger brothers and sisters, and some of you may not have been. We're still getting a few missionaries out of the BYU. There's a growing tendency for a missionary to say, in effect, I'll go if you'll send me to England. Or I'll go if you'll send me to Germany. Or I'll go if you send me to France. I'll go, I'm studying for a doctorate and I want to learn German. And if I can go to Germany, I'll go on a mission. Now that's exaggerated a little, but not too much in some cases. I'd like to suggest to you people that you go where you're sent. And where you're needed. I want to give you my testimony that missionaries are called under the inspiration of the Lord. I don't assign them, but I'm there when they're assigned. And I want to say that they're called under the inspiration of the Lord. Had an interesting experience a while ago. Father and mother came in the office and the mother said, our boy's been called to New England, and we want him to go to Germany. And I said, why? Well, his grandfather came from there, and some other relative came from there. And I said, what does the boy think about it? He doesn't know. I said, you mean you opened his call? Yes. You think that's the right thing to do? That was a letter from the president of the church to your son. I said, I think in the first place you violated the mail statutes of the government, and in the second place I think you've done your boy a great disservice. You've opened a privileged communication, one of the few letters he'll receive in all his life that he'll want to save. Well, the mother's eyes began to well up with tears, and she said, maybe we'd better tell him. He's sitting over in the annex of the temple. So they went over to see him. They were going to the temple. And in about 30 minutes, she came back, and she was red-eyed, and her husband was a little shaky. And she said, we've done a terrible thing. We've wanted our boy to go to Germany, and we've drilled on that and drilled on that. But he said, when we just talked with him, he knew we wanted him to go to Germany. But he didn't want to go to Germany. And he has been praying that the Lord would send him to the Eastern States or to the New England Mission. He had been called to the New England Mission. And that's where he went, and that's where he's serving. Now I want to say that when a missionary indicates he is willing to go on a mission, he sets aside himself, so to speak, and his own selfish desires and surrenders himself to the Lord. And he ought to be willing to go where called. And if he goes where he is called, I think he'll bear testimony, as thousands have done, that he went to the best mission in the church. Parents complain about sending their sons to California, where they've been a dozen times. But the California mission, I want to say, is the most productive mission in all the world today. 2,016 convert baptisms last year. An average of nearly 14 converts per missionary. You people who went elsewhere never saw anything like that. So much for that. Who may perform missionary service? Everyone. But not all may be called. It's a disservice for someone in poor health to want to go on a mission or to ask to go on a mission. The missionary work is rigorous work. I see Brother Robison sitting down there in the congregation. He's just come back from presiding over the finished mission where he's done a marvelous service. I'm sure he'll endorse all I say. Missionaries ought to be in good health. They ought to be vigorous. Girls can't go till they're 23. Not for health reasons, but for other good reasons. Young men can't go till they're 20. Some few older people can go. Had a letter yesterday from a mission president who asked for an older couple to replace a couple who are out now. Two people who thought their lives were through. The man was retired. The woman was on the shelf. They thought life had ended for them. They have gone on a mission. They're having a farewell Sunday evening in the branch in which they have labored. A choir of 50 voices will sing in that farewell, all of whom are converts brought into the church by that couple. The sacrament will be administered to and be passed, and the talks will be given by men and women who have been brought into the church by that couple who thought their lives were over. That man said, I thought I'd made some contribution to the world during my life, but I never did anything till I was past 65 and went on a mission. I'm not making a plea for older missionaries here. We have to watch that. Now, I have 3 minutes left. Just one or two things there. Everybody can't go, but everybody can help. Everybody can teach the gospel, and everybody ought to be equipped to teach the gospel. Every member of this church. But we have many faithful young men and women in foreign lands who can't go because they don't have the means to go. They can maybe raise $10 a month and it takes 60. They need help. In every case, they are required to give some help. And so a lot of people give a little money here and there, which helps them. I have time for just one story, and then I'm through. I brought four with me, but I'm only going to tell one. There came into the office about 3 years ago a little woman with a check for $600. She said, I'd like to help a needy missionary. I reached for it without hesitation and took it and asked her to sit down, and I wanted to hear her story. She joined the church in Scotland. She'd been kicked out of her home, so to speak, disinherited and told not to come back. She'd made her way in the world. She had been married and then widowed. She worked as a cleaning woman in an office building in Salt Lake City and still does. Her family are grown. She had not a son to send on a mission. But she said, all that I have in the world that's good has come of the missionary program of the church. The two young men from whom I heard the glad tidings of the gospel on the flagstone streets of Scotland. I want to help somebody. She's brought in a little money since, and I took occasion yesterday to find out what's come of her money. She has, because of her contributions, missionaries who otherwise would not have been permitted to go have served in Mexico, Brazil, South Australia, Finland, Sweden, North Germany, and South Africa. What a marvelous extension. A little woman who empties wastebaskets and mops floors and polishes desks, whose service, contributions, consecration have made it possible for missionaries to serve in 7 different lands scattered over the earth. Well, brethren and sisters, this is the gospel of Jesus Christ restored to the earth, which must go forth. I conclude with this paragraph, written by the prophet Joseph Smith when he was 36 years of age, a part of the Wentworth letter. No unhallowed hand can stop this work from progressing. Persecutions may rage, mobs may combine, armies may assemble, calumny may defame, But the truth of God will go forth boldly, nobly, and independent till it has penetrated every continent, visited every clime, swept over every country, and sounded in every ear, till the purposes of God shall be accomplished and the great Jehovah shall say, the work is done. That's our responsibility. That's our mission. God help us to fulfill it honorably. I pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.